This is Nancy Casey with an update about the situation in Haiti, where grassroots activists in the country have been responding to the disaster there since the moment it began. Within hours after the earthquake, internet and cell phone technology enabled an unprecedented outpouring of donations from individuals and organizations. On Thursday, January 14th, 2 days after the quake, the International Monetary Fund made public its offer to loan Haiti $100 million and bring the country's debt to that institution to $265 million. These loans come with conditions sometimes called structural adjustment, which demand the cutting of government bureaucracies and public programs, privatization of publicly owned utilities, and open investment policies that eliminate tariffs and import restrictions. In response to this announcement, debt relief organizations such as Jubilee USA mobilized their Facebook and Twitter armies to rise up against what they called the IMF's seizing of the opportunity to tighten the neoliberal screws in its plan for Haiti. A new Facebook group, No Shock Doctrine in Haiti, sprung up, and within a week had 18,000 members appealing to the Obama administration, the IMF, and the World Bank to respond to Haiti's needs with grants and not loans, and to pursue a long-term strategy of economic sovereignty for Haiti. Caving into a week of this pressure, the IMF clarified the terms of the new $100 million loan, calling it an interest-free emergency fund that carries no conditions. The managing director of the IMF, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, said that the IMF had begun working to cancel the entirety of Haiti's now $265 million debt to the fund, a move which Naomi Klein, hailing the effectiveness of public pressure, calls unprecedented. Meanwhile, two senior senators on the Foreign Relations Committee, Chris Dodd, a Democrat from Connecticut, and Richard Lugar, a Republican from Indiana, said that they are drafting legislation to instruct the Secretary of the Treasury to work with other nations to relieve Haiti of their outstanding debt with the International Monetary Fund. In addition to its debt to the IMF, Haiti owes $447 million to the Inter-American Development Bank, $295 million to the government of Venezuela, $39 million to the International Development Association of the World Bank, and $13 million to the International Fund for Agricultural Development. In Port-au-Prince and all over Haiti, workers and volunteers and grassroots groups who have been working for a long time in some aspect of what's often called improving the quality of Haitian life on Haitian terms echo the words of Paul D'Agostino from Ansagale, who said, "We are not a relief agency, at least not until yesterday." One of those people, Sasha Kramer from Sustainable Organic Integrated Livelihoods, or SOIL, describes the role of her group now as, quote, "bridging the gap during the time it takes for the larger organizations to mobilize," unquote. Like many others, she speaks Haitian Creole and has been drawing on longtime relationships in the country to figure out what to do. Kramer writes of a, quote, "network of brave community leaders throughout Port-au-Prince, whom I met during my human rights work from 2004 to 2006. Our team has spent the past several days visiting the camps with them and helping to distribute the resources that we have at our disposal. Each day, we have been purchasing water trucks to deliver to camps that have yet to receive water, giving money to community organizers who are then able to purchase food from local businesses and distribute it to the areas most in need, bringing doctors and medical supplies into zones of the city that have none, providing our generator to community cyber cafes so that the people are able to contact their families, and driving patients from the camps to medical clinics that can receive them." Kramer also writes of coping with the inability of any large organization to have a comprehensive view on the whole situation in Haiti. She writes on her website, soil.org, "When I first arrived in Port-au-Prince, I spent a day at the UN compound by the airport, where NGOs, doctors, and soldiers swarm around, talking on satellite phones and running from meeting to meeting. I learned about the massive amounts of food aid that arrived in the first week and was stockpiled at the airport. I learned of the aid trucks filled to the brim with supplies blocked at the border and sitting idle at the ports. Since that day, I have not returned to the aid compound and chosen instead to go into the streets, into the camps, where people hide from the sun, huddled together under tattered tarps waiting for the food that has yet to come, and into the alleyways littered with the rubble of fallen dreams and the spirits of those we have lost. I know that some of these stories of aid not reaching the victims are beginning to filter into the international media, but I wanted to see if I could shed some light about why this is without casting blame. Everyone who has come here is devastated by this disaster. Everyone wants to help, but the slowness in distribution is not a question of intentions. It is a question of long-standing fears and the security structures put in place in response to these fears. A few days ago, I got an email from Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times asking me to comment on the supposition made by many, although not Nicholas himself, that Haitians have received large amounts of aid money over the years and have somehow squandered it. I responded to him by talking about this fear, this same fear that is slowing down the distribution of aid during this crisis. For centuries, Haiti has been portrayed as a dangerous country filled with volatile and threatening people, unsafe for foreigners. This supposition, this fear and misunderstanding, has very deep implications for foreign aid and cross-cultural understanding. Prior to the quake, I had been amazed to visit friends working with large NGOs in Port-au-Prince, only to learn that they are forced to operate under security restrictions that prevent any kind of real connection to Haitian communities. One friend showed me the map used by all of the larger NGOs where Port-au-Prince is divided into security zones, yellow, orange, red. Red zones are restricted. In the orange zones, all of the car windows must be rolled up and they cannot be visited past certain times of day. Even in the yellow zones, aid workers are often not permitted to walk through the streets and spend much of their time in Haiti riding through the city from one office to another in organizational vehicles. The creation of these security zones has been like the building of a wall reinforced by language barriers and fear, a wall that, unlike many of the buildings in Port-au-Prince, did not crumble during the earthquake. Fear, much like violence, is self-perpetuating. When aid workers enter communities radiating fear, it is offensive. The perceived disinterest in communicating with the poor majority is offensive. Driving through impoverished communities with windows rolled up and armed security guards is offensive, and ironically, all of these extra security measures actually increase the level of risk for aid workers. As I said, this wall of fear is not a new phenomenon. It has had very serious implications for the distribution of the millions of dollars of aid that had been flowing into the country for the past 10 days. Despite the good intentions of the many aid workers swarming around the UN base, people in the camps are suffering and their tolerance is waning, while much of the aid coming through the larger organizations is still blocked in storage, awaiting the required UN and US military escorts that are seen as essential for distribution. The most striking thing I have noticed while visiting the many camps throughout the city is the level of organization and ingenuity among the displaced communities. Community members stand ready to distribute food and water to their neighbors. They are prepared to provide first aid and assist with cleanup efforts. All that they are lacking is the financial means to do so. When the quake struck, people's savings were buried under the rubble of their former homes, banks closed, and no one has been able to access their accounts. Food and water are available for sale in the streets, but no one is able to purchase them. Over the past 5 days, I have been grateful to work with a small organization unhindered by bureaucracy and security restrictions. I am so thankful to work with courageous teams of Haitian community leaders and a respectful and fearless group of Americans whose supporters have given $30,000 to SOIL for immediate relief efforts. We are committed to providing that relief as quickly as we can get the money into the country. The magnitude of this tragedy is unimaginable, and we are aware of our limitations and our inability to help touch more than a small percentage of those affected. It's heartbreaking to think about those we cannot help, but I'm filled with hope to see the impact that we have been able to make. I apologize for not having written for the past few days. It's partly that life here is so hectic and fast-paced, and partly because I find that writing about the situation brings all my emotions to the surface and brings me to a vulnerable space that is too overwhelming. With love from Port-au-Prince, Sasha. Those are the words of Sasha Kramer of Sustainable Organic Integrated Livelihoods, or SOIL, writing in her blog at soil.org. Groups working to dislodge the aid gridlock threatening a food catastrophe on the island of La Gonâve report over the weekend making contact with the U.S. Army and Navy, but food and medical supplies have yet to arrive in any quantity to the island, where tens of thousands of homeless and injured people continue to arrive by boat. This has been an update on the situation in Haiti. You can learn more about the work of groups and individuals mentioned in this update and how to support them by going to www.couragewoman.org. This report was produced by KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and Yin Radio at yinradio.org. I'm Nancy Casey.